From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1895, Mark Twain was in trouble financially. Mind you, at this point, he was the country's most beloved character, had made a fortune. The problem was he was dreadful at business and hopeless at investing. He could have been on the ground floor of the telephone. He passed. Instead, he sunk almost everything into a printing contraption that pretty much ruined him. His only option at the time was to go on tour and perform, tell stories, make people laugh, even though he hated the idea of it. Richard Zack's new book is about this mostly forgotten tour. 1 year, 71 cities, 100 days at sea, 20 cigars a day. It all adds up to a journey where Mark Twain was hoping to make some money and redeem himself along the way. We're talking about the book today, after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mark Twain wasn't perfect. He admitted it himself all the time. This was part of the charm of his writing, his ability to be honest about his own foibles. But the foibles most of us found charming was the cursing, the irreverence, the indolence. What you don't expect is the gullibility. His writing was so skeptical, so clear-eyed, you wouldn't figure Mark Twain could be taken in by a dicey business venture. But the truth is, it happened all the time. And even though he was the country's most successful and beloved writers in 1895, he was bankrupt and desperate. In his new book, the writer and historian Richard Zack says this was a time in Twain's life when he had hoped to be taken more seriously. He wanted to reinvent himself. Instead, he was forced to go on the road and tell his folksy stories to crowds of people. It was an unprecedented and epic performance tour, really. And Zack's book is about the tour. 5 continents, 71 cities. The stakes were really high. And it wasn't just about the money. Twain went on the road to get some redemption as well. The book is called Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. Richard Zacks is joining us today to talk about it. Zacks is an historian, a journalist. His work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, as well as Harper's Magazine. He's written a number of other books about people like Theodore Roosevelt and Thomas Jefferson. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York. And Richard Zacks, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking you, this is one of the things you mentioned in the book, that biographers and people who write about Mark Twain, people who love Mark Twain, they tend to kind of leave out or downplay the financial failures. Why do you figure that is?
I think they're afraid that that bankruptcy is boring, that that no, you know, and I'm frankly, I have sold more copies of every other one of my books than this book, so they might have a point, but I don't think it's boring, and I think it gets at the heart of all of us. We all have money woes, and we're all terrified of losing our money or losing our soul trying to chase more money, and there's so many issues here that I found fascinating, and here you have the funniest man of the century dealing with all those issues. So I just think biographers, a lot of them made the wrong choice to stay with just the literary and skip the financial.
Do you think part of it is what I was mentioning in the introduction there, that the idea of him being kind of gullible? You mentioned his sort of contradictory nature. Suspicion on one hand, gullibility on the other, for example. You write about that. Do you think that gullible part doesn't fit with the myth of Mark
I think you're right. We want him to be the sharpest, funniest guy, which he was. Yeah. But a lot of it came from his insecurities.
Right.
And I think that makes him much more interesting. I'm really proud of this book, and I think I follow in the tradition that Kaplan did and we won the big award for it. It's painting the whole Mark Twain, where this man, he comes, I mean, literally a barefoot river boy who winds up marrying into a coal heiress's family, mm-hmm. and tries to masquerade with a top hat on his head and be a big shot investor. I mean, they're just, and it's a really American story about chasing Carnegie type wealth and failing to get it and having to find your place, your new place that's not going to be the Carnegie or the Vanderbilt. I mean, I think there are a lot of American themes there.
It's interesting. I want to follow up on what you just mentioned, because what he wants at this point in his life, or maybe it's all of his life, is he wasn't really satisfied with ordinary affluence. He wanted Rockefeller-like affluence. I mean, he wanted something really big, I guess.
He did. I think we should maybe paint the picture for listeners that in 1885, everything was going unbelievably well for him. He'd just published Huckleberry Finn. He had just bought his own publishing company, founded his own publishing company that was, for its first release, was publishing the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest success in the history of American publishing. He was just this phenomenal success at age 50. And he even wrote about that everything he touches turns to gold. There's this hubris tone, and then it all starts to fall apart because he chases this, like you said, this Rockefeller wealth, this phenomenal wealth, and he just couldn't leave it alone. He said, man will do many things to get himself loved. He will do all things to get himself envied. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason he could come up with a brilliant line like that was because he profoundly felt it. He wanted to be envied. He wanted to walk into the hotel restaurant and all the heads turn, and he wanted to have the biggest house that everyone envied. His decorations were by Tiffany on his ground floor. I mean, he married a coal heiress. He didn't marry a Vanderbilt, but he just couldn't stop.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that he, at this stage in his life, you know, he's 60 in 1895 anyway, where you begin the story,
right.
He wanted to be thought of. He didn't want to be just the sort of the clown up on the platform. He wanted to be more taken more seriously as a writer and as a character, I guess.
That's also a fascinating angle to the story because, just to explain to people a little bit, there was two basic types of publishing back then. There was subscription publishing and there was retail bookstore sales. And Twain was sold door to door. I mean, we think of Mark Twain, and your introduction was accurate about him being such a successful writer, but he was a successful funny writer.
Yeah.
He wasn't thought of then as a quote-unquote great literary writer. He was thought of as the man who wrote funny travel books. He was always introduced as the guy who wrote Innocents Abroad and Roughing It, which a lot of modern, you know, Americans have forgotten. Those are great, great books. There's nothing wrong with being known for that, but they're not Huckleberry Finn. And he craved a bigger reputation. Some of his friends were, I mean, a lot of people have forgotten the name William Dean Howells, but that was Twain's best author, editor friend. And Howells was considered a greater literary writer than Twain at the time. And it really annoyed Twain. And it annoyed Twain's wife, Livy. And so he tried to start writing these more respectable books like Prince and the Pauper, mm-hmm, and Connecticut Yankee. And then eventually he wrote... Look, I'm prejudiced on this, but he wrote Joan of Arc, which I just consider almost unreadable. Some people will say it's one of Twain's best books. I can't get through it. So you have to picture this man who's known as being incredibly funny, who's trying to become two things, a businessman and a literary writer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's pretty much failing at both those two tasks, and that's where we find him.
It's interesting. This caught my eye. There was one of the Adam Davidson, co-host of NPR's Planet Money. He blurbed your book, and he talks about it as being a really good business book. And in some ways, it seems it is a business book on some level. Although I think it's, you have to be careful about saying that, I guess, because people, I think, as you were sort of referring to earlier, may find that in some way boring, but it's not. I mean, the fact that the businesses that he chased, the businesses he passed on, like passing on the telephone, for example, was really fascinating. Some of the terrible ideas that he invests in and interest him. Would you just talk a little bit about that part of his life?
Sure, sure. I was just reminding myself, some of the inventions that he invented an elastic strap to hold up pants,
right,
because people were wearing suspenders and he thought there should be a custom, and people weren't wearing belts, so he thought there should be a custom system that attached the shirt to the pants via an elastic strap that was just kind of hidden, and he was convinced it was going to make a fortune. He invented bed clamps to keep like the sheets on when toddlers want to kick their bed covers off, their sheets, their blankets. He had this restless mind. I mean, one of his inventions actually scored quite a success. Now, he completely botched the marketing of it,
yeah,
But it was called the Mark Twain Self-Adhesive Scrapbook.
Yeah.
And no one had done it yet. There were it was a scrapbook with these thin lines of dried glue that you took a wet rag and you moistened, and then you dropped your newspaper clip, your letter, your photograph, and it stuck to the page. And it was a huge success. But, of course, Twain found this business partner who was a complete con man, who he had met on one of his pilgrim, you know, the ship earlier in life. And Twain wound up making money, but not making nearly as much as he should have made with this invention.
So he has that sort of that one success. So he's got that. But his biggest boondoggle, at least one of the biggest anyway, is this typesetting machine. Let's talk a little bit about this, and maybe start with James W. Page, the Shakespeare of mechanical invention, as
right.
Twain
James
calls
w.
him.
James W. Page is a hummingbird of a man who he said that Twain later wrote that Page could convince a fish to come out and take a walk with him.
Right.
And he just was an unbelievable. Twain wrote in one notebook entry. I had access to these unpublished notebooks, by the way, which was a lot of fun to read some of this stuff for the first time. I mean, other scholars had read it, but they hadn't been published. Twain shed more tears this time than usual.
Yeah.
I mean, he must have been such a con man. And but he was indeed working on this invention of the typesetter. And now you have to put it in context. There had not been a real breakthrough in typesetting since Gutenberg.
Yeah.
Basically, if you think about it, people took little pieces of type. They put them in a form or a box, in effect. They put little wedges of spacers in, and that's how it had been done for 400 years. Twain, in fact, his first job was a printer's apprentice, printer's devil, they called it. And he had to he had done that. He knew how difficult it was and how tedious, unbelievably tedious, to put each letter in there and then put each letter back in the A box, the B box, the C box. He knew it. So the whole quest was to invent a device that you could just press a key, like the A key, and it would send that piece of type into the box at the exact right place. But if you think about it, it's a way more complicated proposition than it seems, because if you have a certain number of words, you need the spacing to work out equally. So you're going to need different size spacers. So Twain gets involved with Page, and they had 9 different size automatic spacers that would be put in there. And the Twain almost thought it was like there was no word computer, but he thought the machine could think, because it had to figure out which of the 9 exactly same size sized spacers would go in the slot there. And it became unbelievably complicated. And all it took was a little ink to gum it up and the rest of it. And Page worked on it for over 20 years.
Right.
And Twain was always convinced. He wrote in his notebook one time, "Eureka," in block caps with about half a dozen exclamation points. He thought Page had finally mastered all the problems. And it just never did. Maybe it's like Theranos, that Elizabeth Holmes story, where she has an amazing idea, but she's one tweak away from making the blood drops work as opposed to a whole vial of blood. And that's what James W. Page was like.
One tweak from perfection. 18,000 moving parts, you mentioned.
Right.
Never does, of course, really go through. And give us a sense, because I want to sort of establish where Mark Twain is in 1895. I mean,
sure.
Have you sort of calculated how much money he's lost at this point?
Well, I did. I wanted to make one simple sentence, and I probably took more research time than anything else I did for the book. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to one sentence that said Mark Twain lost more money than he earned over the course of the first 60 years of his life. And I'm 99% sure that that's true, because his wife came with, in effect, like a million. He married a million heiress or whatever.
Yeah.
He married an heiress, and he used her money for day-to-day expenses. And even though he made so much money from some of his books, he lost more with investments. But I can't remember if I finally got enough to have the courage to. It was very close. But just to put it in context, he had made his first book, Innocents Abroad, was an enormous bestseller for the door-to-door model. And like I said, he had 30% of the profits of the Grant book, which is the biggest book in the history of publishing. But he succeeded in dropping – he was paying $4,000 a week, when that was $120,000 a month, for this Page typesetter to have 60 workmen. It was a nightmare. I said that he had moonshot enthusiasm and no patience for details.
Right.
And think about that for an investor. That's the worst possible combination you can have.
You tell the story. It's kind of touching, actually. Twain himself, you quote him as, you know, saying he never felt so desperate in his life. He said, "I do not sleep these nights for visions of the poorhouse," he said. Everything looks so dismally blue. I mean, he's just... Yeah. Did you ever get a sense that he may have, in some way, or anyone in his family, because they were all obviously desperate, contemplating like something like suicide? Did you ever get a sense it was that bad?
Absolutely. Yeah. Twain used to joke, the dark joke, that his wife forbid him or else he would have done it. Livy forbid it. Mm-hmm. And Livy used to talk about it after a family tragedy that they have later in the book. Right. So she just wouldn't allow herself to do it, but she envies those who do. So, yeah, this – I mean, you have to put it in context. Imagine – I mean, the arc of my career, the arc of your career, with all due respect, most listeners' careers, I mean, they don't go to the point where you are considered the funniest writer in America. He was at the pinnacle. Yeah. He was also married an heiress. He lived in a mansion, and he had succeeded in messing it all up. I mean, it was really hard to do on some level. It took a man that had such courage and such incredible stupidity with investments, and he needed risk. I think if she had let him play poker once a week, this never would have happened.
That's true.
He put all his risk into these insane investments.
You tell this one story about him approaching some of his Hartford businessman friends to borrow some money. I think he was looking for $5,000 because really desperate. And they turn him down. And then you have one of those memorable sayings, one of the about friendship. I wanted to, maybe you can quote it at this point. But it made me realize that some of his funny, really memorable lines and maxims that you see quoted from time to time are kind of more tortured and maybe more ironic than
I think that's true. I mean, I'm going to botch the quote, but it's something to the effect that friendship is an honorable and desirable and wonderful thing, except when asked to borrow money.
Right.
You know, and he puts it way better than that. That's just a I think that's what I enjoyed the most about researching this book was discovering the man back here who he wasn't just sitting there very witty making up these funny things. He was profoundly feeling these things. And he felt that so deeply. He felt that no one in his hour of need, except for one man, was willing to lend him money. And that one man happened to be a guy named H.H. Rogers, who was one of the wealthiest men in America. And in effect, if he had lent Twain money, he wouldn't have noticed he was so wealthy.
Right.
But, yeah.
Let's talk about that man, Henry Huddleston Rogers, H.H. Rogers. It's interesting. You mentioned how literary people and biographers, this is another one of those things that people have kind of glossed over this relationship. Why do you figure it is? I mean, this was an incredibly wealthy man, and maybe this doesn't live up to the Twain myth either, that he's friends with this super rich guy.
I think you're absolutely right. The myth is not – we don't want to picture Mark Twain doing what today would be considered insider trading, but –
Right.
What in effect? I had to do some research on this, and it wasn't really considered illegal to the Securities Act of 1934 or whatever. But Twain got insider tips. I mean, H.H. Rogers was known as Hellhound Rogers. He was one of the most predatory businessmen of the era. He set up Federal Steel. He did Amalgamated Copper. He was number two or three man at Standard Oil, working directly with John D. Rockefeller. I just think a lot of the biographers of Twain wanted to stay with the literary types and stay on the Mississippi River, and they wanted the folksy image. And I personally find this way more fascinating. Yeah. Twain was so profoundly envious of Rogers' wealth. It just comes through all over. This librarian up at the Rogers Library up in Massachusetts told me that she said that I think their relationship was based on mutual envy. And I thought that was a profound line. Rogers always tried to be funny, and he was definitely considered witty and articulate, but he was no Mark Twain. Right. And so he wanted to be the funnier guy that everyone loved when he walked into the room, and Twain wanted to be that wealthy man that everyone feared when he walked in the room. So I thought that was a great line from this woman, mutual envy.
It did seem like a legitimate friendship, too. I mean, you say they became fast friends pretty much on the spot.
Yeah, they did. I mean, Rogers was offering to lend that $5,000 you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Rogers was lending it to him.
Right.
So Twain had a Right, it didn't hurt. But I think Twain really – I think it started as a marriage of convenience, friendship of convenience, and I think it became a really profound friendship. I think he truly became Twain's best friend, absolutely. And Twain said that several times to his death, which it just sort of makes a lot of biographies a little ridiculous that they give, you know, Rogers maybe a paragraph or a page. They played pool together. They told bawdy jokes. They took all these trips later in life. Rogers took him on his yacht, which was like the second fastest yacht in America, to J.P. Morgan. Some people think it was faster. And they went to the Bahamas. Twain would get seasick. He was a river pilot, so he wasn't used to all the waves, and he'd get seasick. And one time he was throwing up over the side, and Rogers sent one of the crewmen over to ask if he could help and can I bring you anything? And Twain said, "Yeah, bring me a little island."
Yeah, right.
I mean, they had a great time together.
Yeah. You ask this question in the book: did Mark Twain really consider poverty so hateful? He didn't have an extravagant taste in clothing or food, but he liked to live well, or at least you say liked the feeling of being wealthy. What was his relationship with poverty? I mean, he was thought of as a common man. He wrote these, you know, he would write these really critical essays, at least early in his life, about capitalism, those kinds of things. How did he view poverty in the end, do you figure?
I think he viewed it as honorable and keep it as far away from me as possible.
Right.
I mean, he was the guy that could be wearing the top hat that would talk to the servants. He was wonderful that way. He always, you know, talked to the waiters, learn about personality, sit on the step with the former slave who's now the cook. He was amazing that way. But I just think in that Victorian society just was so obsessed, I mean, with wealth and with, I mean, the front page of the papers had the marriage of a Vanderbilt to the, you know, the Churchill family, he just couldn't quite escape his era with this idolization of wealth and adoration. He just couldn't get there. And so he could write a lot of, create these wonderful characters who were poor. I mean, probably Huckleberry Finn he talks about envying him because he was so poor that he could do anything he wanted. He'd go barefoot, not go to school, sleep where he wanted. But still, Twain wasn't quite ready as a grown-up adult married to an heiress to look barefoot.
Richard Zaks is with us. His book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a story of Mark Twain you may not have heard. Of course, Twain was one of America's most brilliant writers. He was funny, of course, clear-eyed, skeptical. So it's surprising just how gullible he could be and just the worst investor ever. The writer Richard Zaks begins his book at the point when Twain is in financial ruin and he embarks on this year-long five-continent performance tour to pay off his debts. The book is called Chasing the Last Laugh, and Richard Zaks is joining us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. He knows he has to go out on this tour. But let's talk a little bit about that, because he knew this was could be anyway way out of the financial difficulties, but he didn't like the idea. You said that he called it the dreadful platform. I mean, he didn't want to be perceived as playing the clown. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because his daughter said that's nonsense. He kind of liked it. It was unclear whether he liked playing that role or he didn't like playing that role.
Yeah, absolutely. He was incredibly good at it,
yeah.
And some of it was a little bit of a posture that he claimed. He said that once audiences see you stand on your head, they're going to expect you to remain in that position forever.
Right.
I mean, he liked the laughs, and his good friend William Dean Howell said that it appealed to the actor side of him, but it was dreadful for the author side of him. So, I mean, that's what's so great about Twain. There's this split personality there. He just wasn't completely comfortable making people laugh with those folksy tales once he got later in life. I think he wanted to be giving these profound speeches and writing more literary prose like Joan of Arc and just reading them. And so it definitely made him uncomfortable. But on the other hand, he knew you could make – I mean, the money that you could make from performance – think about it. There was no TV, no movies, no radio. That was everything. And he could make so much more money by doing a live performance.
Let's talk about the performance itself. You've mentioned that one of the things that stands out for Twain as a performer was his nerve. He never smiled on the stage, and he took his time to deliver a line. Talk about what it might have been like to have seen a Mark Twain performance.
I can't imagine the courage that he had to deliver things that way. I mean, I can't think of anyone. I mean, there was a I don't know if he's still doing stand-up. Stephen Wright, who just talked in this monotone and looked kind of – Well, I mean, we don't picture Mark Twain that way. Mark Twain had a little twinkle in his eyes, and he didn't – and he actually was quite dramatic looking in a more positive way, I'd say, than Stephen Wright. But Twain had the courage to talk unbelievably slowly and not to smile and to pretend to be the rube who doesn't understand – why anything he's saying is funny. You know, like he'll tell a story about buying his first horse and a man came up to me and gave me some advice. He was the auctioneer's brother. You know, and he'll say it like that and get a big laugh. I can't imitate it. You have to be in the middle of the story. But to have the courage to, you know, it's the stupidity of the guy standing there that doesn't, you know that an auctioneer's brother is going to tell him something that's going to be bad for him. I still can't. And then his most popular story was Huck and Jim on the raft.
Right.
So that's a more familiar one. And he basically thought, with all due respect to most writers today, that it was a crime for writers to just read from their works.
Yeah.
That the written word did not suit the spoken, you know, the audience sitting there listening. And he adapted everything. And he was really into getting it just right. He would his own books have like triple underlines for emphasis and exclamation points, and he even writes in the margin "blubber here," like he's telling the story of Huck and, you know, on the raft, "blubber here." You know, he must have been — everyone who saw him just raved that it was a once in a lifetime experience. And that was a little bit of the trouble of doing doing it in a book, is trying to get that across.
I loved how you write about how it was his wife who talked him into putting the Huck and Jim story into the performance, and that people in New Zealand and Australia and India really took to that story. They really related to it. And you said, I think you mentioned in the book, it was probably the most important part of that performance, or the really poignant part of that performance.
Well, Twain was insecure enough that he thought he had to make them laugh. That they no one came to Mark Twain and not expecting to laugh. He was literally advertised on billboards as the funniest man of the century, the greatest humorist of the century. So they were coming there to laugh, and he thought that's what he should do. And the first few times out, he did — all the stories had joke lines, and he called them nubs. They all built to punch lines. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, rambling stories with lots of laughs built in. And Livy told him, you got to let the audience come up for air.
Yeah,
and she also was, you know, again, a Victorian woman with some society urges. She just wasn't comfortable with him being viewed as a clown. So she suggested adding them on the raft, and Huck and Jim on the raft. And it turned out to be the scene. He did it in Minneapolis. He did it and it turned out to be a huge success. And he wound up doing it. Like you say, it's kind of uncanny that the thing played in Australia, New Zealand, India, South Africa. Well, actually not South Africa. That brings up an interesting point. He actually self-censored and did not do the story.
Right.
Yeah.
Where race was such an issue. What do you make of that?
It was uncomfortable for me to discover it. No biographer had ever pointed it out, and I just started looking through his speech lists, and I realized, my God, he did, Huck and Jim the first couple times in South Africa, and then the next whatever it is, 30-something, 20-something, no. And then he did it again towards the end. I make that he was on a tour to make money,
yep.
And he was being pragmatic, and he wasn't being a – you know, actually, he also – people don't realize this. We all think of him so stridently anti-imperialist and for fairer race relations. He wasn't hugely political during interviews after he botched it in Australia. In the first week he was there, he made some comments mm-hmm. that weren't taken well, and he decided for the rest of the trip to not be as political. But to his credit, when he wrote the book, he unleashed all guns, you know, against imperialism and against racism. When he was finally in print and he wasn't just trying to sell tickets,
yeah.
he came out with his views. So. I don't know if that makes him a hypocrite or just a guy who's
patient.
Well,
it makes him human, and I think that's sort of the point of the book, a big
right.
part of it anyway. I love the debut performance in Cleveland you write about, and you have such great detail about all of these performances. I wanted to ask you about this one because he has these kind of demands or these pet peeves about his performances. He demands starting on time. He
right.
only wanted to do 90 minutes. He figured, you know, I guess leave them wanting more, I suppose. Didn't want an introduction. And he didn't tolerate musical acts.
Right.
And on that first performance in Cleveland, there was a musical chamber act,
right.
I guess.
A husband and wife, newlyweds, and with a 100-year-old violin, and absolutely. But I love the bit about no introductions. He got so tired of people saying that he was the funniest man in the world right. and saying it badly. He was tired of the Rotary Club-type introduction that was just so botched. He said just aching to be funny and not the least bit funny. And finally, he just got so sick of it. For a while, he had some friend of his stand up and do a couple of lines. I don't know this man. But if I did, the one thing I wonder is why he's not in the penitentiary or just something just to break up the house a little bit and get it started. And then he just started walking out there and jumping right in almost with no introduction. And again, that is incredibly courageous. That's not building up, you know, here's, you know, I don't know, whoever you want, Bruce Springsteen. And then people talk about all this Grammy and, you know, all the rest of it. I mean, just walked out there an older man with a massive gray hair, curly hair. Everyone talked about the hair. It was rock star hair
yeah.
that he had and that mustache. And it was breaking convention to look that way. I mean, him and Paderewski were like the two hair gods of the era, you know.
But this was before the white suit, though. I mean, he wore a formal
Absolutely.
Black suit on stage.
He did. The white suit came later when he went to Washington for copyright, and he stood out and he called it his Don't Care a Damn's. That he would just wear it whenever he wanted, and he'd start wearing it year-round. But no, this was a formal black suit. Again, you just can't believe the courage of an older man strolling out there and just looking serious. He actually propped his hand on his chin. He had his chin supported by his hand, and he just and people just literally were dying with laughter. They had trouble catching their breath. There were a couple times people had to be taken out because they couldn't stop laughing and they were destroying the show for everybody else. You know, again, these things are hard to get across. I mean, I did my best to. The big thing that he used was the pause.
Yeah.
He would time it perfectly. He'd wait and then say something so unexpected. And apparently he did that in real life as well, which was a little hard on some friends sometimes because, you know, you never know when to jump in. And, you know, like you and I, we don't want to interrupt each other, but people would think he was done and he was just building to that perfect line that he'd wait 6 seconds before delivering. So very slow.
We'll get to some of the particulars of the tour. I want to talk about India in particular. That seemed really inspirational, I think, for Mark Twain. Other points, too, when we get back from a break. Richard Zaks is with us. His book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's Raucous and Redemptive Round-the-World Comedy Tour. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Richard Zaks. We're talking about his new book, Chasing the Last Laugh. I wonder what, Richard Zaks, what kind of web surfer Mark Twain might have been, because you write about his notebooks that and you went through it must have been dozens of these notebooks, and you talk about you've written about his as you've described it, his bizarre range of interests, worst public floggings, religious preferences in ant colonies, the anonymity of executioners. What was it like going through those notebooks, and what did you learn about his nature from all of that?
He had some very bizarre interests. There's no doubt about it. And I felt really lucky. The Berkeley, you know, Mark Twain Project has only gotten up to 1891 with publishing the notebooks because the 100 years have elapsed and they were able to publish his autobiography. So they seem to have put some of their energies into that. So my story takes place 1895 to 1900. So it's I got to look at all those. His interests are just so all over the map. He, like you say, the ant colonies, and he also, you know, we were going to get to talk about India. He just was loved things that I think he was like a little boy who loved the circus coming to town, and he felt like India was a constant circus with the clothes and the dancing girls and the elephants and camels that he saw near the Taj Mahal, and it just was. But you bring up another point with what kind of web surfer. I wondered what kind of Twitter account he'd have,
right.
You know, because he hated to give away. He wouldn't allow his performances to be recorded because he thought someone would start making pirate wax cylinders. They didn't use records then, wax cylinders. He was convinced they'd start selling them, and then he couldn't perform and make all this money if he chose to. So I wonder if he'd be willing to tweet. I think he would feel like he was giving it away.
Yeah.
He'd probably tease tweet a little, like just a couple of tweets that were so much better than everybody else's, just to remind everyone. But I don't know if he'd do it that often. But the notebooks are like seeing his Twitter account, probably.
Right. His time in India, you've written about the fact that he found himself forced to confront his opinions of not only his religion, but other people's religions. Would you say something about that? His sort of what he learned in India about religion, because he seemed to think a lot about it at that time.
Sure. I think he thought that people should be tolerant of other people's religion, but he wasn't too patient with the idea of missionary work.
Right.
He basically said that he thought that missionaries should not try and impose their beliefs on someone else. And so he wrote in his notebook that he had heard that Christian missionaries had achieved little success converting Hindus, but they had scored some breakthroughs with monkeys. He wrote, in 2 years at a cost of $60,000, 4 monkeys converted and 11 hopefully interested, which is just vintage Mark Twain. I mean, he's just making fun of the missionaries, and he's you know, at first you think he's going to be tolerant and kind of, you know, and then he just slams you. And I think the next level line is hopefully interested, 11 hopefully interested. But
right.
He, you know, he's just pushing it.
The Ganges, he took a boat down the Ganges, that seemed to I wanted you to maybe say something about that, because that seemed to really gives him some kind of impact, seeing what he saw.
Yeah, he was amazed at, I mean, he's, you know, I don't know how much, you know, how much any of us know about the Hindu religion, but the corpses are burned and some buried, you know, in the Ganges. So there are corpses floating in the Ganges. And yet also the Ganges water is completely holy, and it's meant to be drunk and meant to be washed in. This is a holy ritual. And so Twain was just amazed that someone's faith in their religion could lead a person to drink water right by a corpse. And he said that, you know, he could question a lot of things about Hindus, but one thing he could not question is their sincerity. You know, you think about it, to do something like that, you have to be sincere in your religious beliefs. So he was just amazed. There also, the whole bit of washing with the nudity. Nudity, he was kind of fascinated by, I mean, India is a very hot country, and people weren't wearing, you know, as much clothes as he was used to back in New York or back in Missouri. So he was kind of fascinated by that, and he couldn't believe that the Indian women were so adept at spinning out of a wet sari and into a dry one without revealing any bronze. So it just was a constant. He couldn't believe when he first saw the dancers at a wedding. He thought they were pubescent girls, and they turned out to be boys. I mean, He just he saw wealth that he had never seen. There was a palace there for someone that he performed for, the Gaikwar of Baroda, who was four times the size of Buckingham Palace. And the man's property was the size of the state of Connecticut. I mean, Twain just saw all the – he was just fascinated. It was just a constant show. And he said it was the only country that he ever had any desire to go back and visit again. And he had been to virtually every country in Europe and had traveled all over. And this was the only place he said that he would like to see again.
He and Livy it seems odd that you would go to Europe to live cheaply.
Save money.
To save money, which is what they did. What was their life like in France?
They are just such a...
He was pretty merciless in terms of the way he would tease the French. But what did they make of Mark Twain there?
Well, see, I think the reason he did that is he wasn't recognized on the street as much in France. Yeah. In Germany, he was considered our—I can't pronounce it in German—but our beloved guest or whatever. He was the honored guest of the whole nation, and in France, they ignored him to a large extent. So, of course, he didn't like France. And then he had a big run-in with some famous French writers over some things he had written. And they went there. I think the big reason they went to live in Europe to save money was because they could no longer afford to live in Hartford with their horses and carriages and seven servants. Mm-hmm. And the idea of living, you know, this is what's so amazing about Mark Twain. I mean, I think I could live without cars and, you know, blah, 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 next to all my neighbors and, you know, not mow my the grass is a ridiculous example, but, you know, let things. I think I could do that, but I'm not sure. But he couldn't. He and his wife couldn't. And so they made this excuse of going to Europe for Livy's health and the children's, lessons in singing and music. And they left, and they could have actually saved some money, of course, if they had lived on a budget in Europe. They stayed at some of the better hotels. And Livy's idea of saving money was that they would rent a place and she would start housekeeping, as she put it, which meant they would have servants instead of having every meal served by the hotel at extraordinary cost in their parlor at the hotel. She would start housekeeping. I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous.
Right. Well, he arrives back from the tour in October, and this is what's so interesting. He had been publicly shamed for very much so, and but you say this is this fact which you call odd and wonderful that. Most of America winds up loving Mark Twain more for failing in some way. Would you talk about that?
I think that's really true, and it was a wonderful discovery to see that happen. He was going on to be this kind of, I won't say smug, but this popular humorist, and that's where he had kind of peaked. And then he has this crash, and he gets completely humbled, and he had to scrape himself up, and there was, you know, they didn't call it a depression. They called it the Panic of 1893. You know, 20-30% of America out of work, and people are really suffering, and credit is frozen. No one can get any money to start any businesses, and people can't pay their debts. And a lot of people, I would use the word hid behind the bankruptcy laws, took advantage of the bankruptcy laws. And Mark Twain did not hide behind those laws. He with Livy... Livy was adamant that we must pay all our debts in full. And I think people were so shocked that this glib comedian, as it were, was the one guy or one of the few people who took 4 years to pay everyone back in full. And they were just really proud. You know, they were just coming out of that depression, that panic of 1893. And here Mark Twain does this. And I would argue that he resurrected his career. They came out with a uniform complete works of Mark Twain that included obviously Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, and he became a huge success, and he started to finally get that literary applause that he wanted. He restored his finances, and that welcome home in October was covered everywhere, and it was an amazing moment.
Sometime after they returned, he goes for like a couple of months. He's feted and pampered on this crazy kind of scale. And sometime after they get back, he goes back into the house, the beloved house, the mansion there in Hartford. He goes in just to look at the place. I guess this is one of the kind of tragedies, at least for his family, that they never did return to live in that mansion.
Yeah, it's true. It is a sad mo. A few days after they got back, one of their friends, his co-writer, Charles Dudley Warner, died suddenly up in Hartford, so he couldn't not attend the funeral. So when he went up there with his daughter, they decided that they would go in the old house, which had basically been either empty or rented very briefly for the last 7 years. It hadn't been used. And it was just too sad. The reason it was too sad was that their daughter, Susie, their 23-year-old daughter, had died there of spinal meningitis. And while they were traveling around the world to pay off these debts, and Twain could not disassociate the house with Susie's death, and they eventually sold the house. He succeeded on a lot of levels, but he did not, because of Susie's death, he didn't recreate this happy family life that he hoped. And in fact, his family life was pretty tortured as well. So he couldn't, that wasn't the happy moment. No.
No. It's funny. I mean, that whole, not funny. It's not funny, actually, that his family life was pretty bad. I mean, Livy has this kind of strange illness, and she's prescribed this odd sounding treatment. It's basically solitary confinement. He really wasn't
so
able
terrible.
To see her at all.
Oh, so terrible! I can't believe the isolation cure, the rest cure, that Mark Twain is not allowed to see his wife except for some. And during some periods, he would get a couple minutes a day. During other periods, he had to just send her notes. They were convinced that her being alone with just basically a nurse was the way for her to recover. But I just think it's almost cruel. You want to go back and sue those doctors.
Yeah.
And Twain needed the outlet of Livy to keep his sense of humor. And he got darker and darker as Livy got sicker and sicker. And as Livy died in 04, I would sort of group the Mark Twain before Livy's death and the Mark Twain after Livy's death. And a lot of people remember the grumpy Mark Twain from 1904 to 1910, which I think is really unfair. The man lived 70-odd years, and you shouldn't just judge the last six. But
well, Susie died young. Livy died young. Jean, his other daughter, dies. His relationship with Clara was pretty
not good.
Not good. It was pretty strained.
Huh.
But he does go through, you also mention, and you were sort of referred to it earlier, that at the end of his life, he hangs out a lot with H.H. Rogers, and it's mischievous and kind of exuberant. So he does have that kind of, that coda in his life where he seemed to really be
right.
enjoying himself.
Right, and you can't put all of it, I mean, people want to quote some of the dark stories, and he was some of a literary pose, the anti-imperialism. Twain was still having some fun. They have these stories of Carnegie, Twain having his servant call Carnegie to send over two bottles of scotch.
Right.
Andrew Carnegie himself is so irritated by the thing, he starts sending over more and more scotch. And finally, he sends over an entire barrel of whiskey to Mark Twain's house on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And then Carnegie comes himself over there and says at the door to the servant, maybe this will finally shut him up.
Right.
You know, I mean, they were. Twain gave a very bawdy speech for the wealthy 10 men or so that were on H.H. Rogers' yacht about only joining the club if you have a certain anatomical whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we
it's
won't
a
go
great
there.
Little section, by the way. Yeah.
So it's not all grim, and he has Helen Keller over to the house in Reading and invites her to play pool with him. I mean, he's still having fun.
I found this really interesting. Do you figure he learned his lesson about bad investing? Because he was still kind of a terrible investor.
No, he didn't learn his lesson at all. And in fact, he did almost the day that he got out of debt when he still was overseas. He hadn't come back yet. He started investigating a fabric copying, design copying device that he claimed, I've reeled in a big fish today. And he wrote that to H.H. Rogers, who must have slammed the table or the whatever when he read it. Like, oh, no, not this again, this madman. And then so Rogers talks him out of the textile device. And Twain, without talking to Rogers, sinks a big sum of money into a protein powder called plasmin.
Right.
Which, again, Plasmin USA, he lost the full $30,000 to a hustler named Henry Butters, you know. And Twain did a whole speech in court about he could have stand losing the $30,000, but to a man named Butters. So, you know, he never really learned.
He did he was able to leave a decent fortune to his daughter, to Clara.
He did. He left the equivalent of $500,000, which times 30 is, you know, $15 million. And it wasn't H.H. Rogers or Vanderbilt money, but I'd probably put him in the top 5%. I'm just guessing. Yeah, he left a large fortune. Unfortunately, only one of his daughters was still alive, right. The one he was fairly estranged from, Clara, but she wound up getting it all. And
this is the best part, though. He stipulates in his will that this money that he's giving to his daughter be free from interference from her husband.
I know. You got to love that. Because he had so botched Libby's money.
Yeah.
And so now he's learning from his mistakes, but it will affect somebody else, not him. And so Mark Twain.
He all his life wanted to get. I mean, in his early days, he didn't get much in the way of royalties. Not percentage-wise.
Right,
and he always
right.
was looking. I mean, at one point, he wanted 90% royalties. He ended up with a decent cut with Harper Book. This was, again, H.H. Rogers helps him with this.
Right.
Say something about this, finally. He gets a decent deal with Harper Books.
He did. I thought it was his lifelong quest. He called it 50% net profit sharing.
Yep.
So anyone in business will understand what that is. He didn't think the publisher should earn more money from Mark Twain's writing or anyone's writing, my writing, than the author himself. So that was his lifelong quest. And H.H. Rogers, it turned out that it would take a 15 or 17% royalty. That's the percent of the list price of the book for Twain to earn 50% net profit. And H.H. Rogers, probably the only man on the planet that could have got Twain that deal. Twain kept coming up with more suggestions for how to structure the deal. It would have totally been a disaster. He never would have gotten it. But Rogers tuned Twain out. Luckily, Twain was traveling most of the time and got him this amazing deal. So Twain did get 50% net, maybe even 60% net. And that enabled him to basically die a wealthy man, to restore his fortune.
Richard Zacks. This book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. Joined us from the studios of NPR New York. Richard Zacks, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks. This was fun.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.